Hello, loyal listeners, and welcome to a special milestone 50th episode of Batman Nightcast, a proud and oh-so-dependable part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
And as you are no doubt aware, unless, of course, this is your first time hearing Batman Nightcast, in which case, welcome to the party. But if you're a longtime listener, you probably know that the agenda, the remit for the show, is quite different than it was when we started almost 10 years ago. At launch, the goal was to cover every issue of Batman and his related comics set in the post-Crisis on Infinite Earths universe in chronological order. Obviously, we've pivoted multiple times and paused a number of times. But Chris, you want to hear a wild fact?
I would love to hear a wild fact.
Had we stayed on schedule and with the original plan, we would have hit Batman Nightcast episode 50 on September 11th, 2020. And on that episode, we would have covered the first issue of Batman the Cult.
Oh, wow.
Little peek into what might have been, which is
yes.
Maybe a little bit thematically appropriate for this particular episode.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the road not taken.
That's the Batman Nightcast of Earth 2.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I've still got my poster from Batman the Cult where the hordes of the Deacon Blackfire are chasing Batman through the sewer. By Bernie Wrightson, and I've still got that somewhere. Huge. It was like an extra size poster. It wasn't like your standard comic, you know, poster you buy at the comic shop. That thing was huge. It took up like a whole wall in my room as a kid, as a teenager.
Oh, Bernie Wrightson, man.
Yeah, exactly.
You gotta go big at that
one. Yeah.
That's why I told Rob I'm amazed that they never had a Treasury of Swamp Thing. They had Swamp Thing in every other format.
Yeah, that is so weird. Why didn't they do that? I mean, yeah, there was, you know, there was the Swamp Thing Batman story was reprinted in that Strange Cases of Batman, but yeah, there was no Swamp Thing reprint. That's right, yeah.
Any other Batman fun facts or stuff that's going on?
Well, just, toy news, because we like to, you and I both collect action figures and toys, and so each episode we seem to talk about that a lot, but you know, there's been several new DC multiverse figures that were solicited over the past few weeks as we record this. They released the comic version of the Batman 89 Joker, which I think is hilarious because the comic adaptation of Batman 89 drawn by Jerry Ordway, they had to get the likeness rights cleared by Jack Nicholson, Michael Keaton, Kim Basinger, etc. And so this still is kind of sort of a Jack Nicholson Joker figure, but it's not, so they don't have to pay his absorbent license fees. Yeah, that was solicited. But there's also been leaks of a list, and usually these lists end up being pretty accurate. There's supposedly a Neil Adams Batman and a Silver Age Robin, which probably means it's really a Bronze Age Teen Wonder Dick Grayson Robin. And also a Batman 66 two-pack with Batman and Robin. So if you have the Adam West Batman, now you got to buy another one to get Burt Ward, which I don't like. But, you know, there you go.
I assumed that the 89 Joker wasn't based on the original Jerry Ordway one, but the new Batman 89 series from a couple years ago.
Did the Joker even appear in that comic? Maybe in flashbacks? I don't know. I bought the first run of it and didn't finish it because, one, it took forever to come out, and honestly didn't like it. So, but good segue. I did read a good sequel to Batman 89, Batman Resurrection by John Jackson Miller, which you have been recommending for quite some time. I really enjoyed it. It was great. Cindy was just gobsmacked that I was reading a book that didn't have pictures in it, even though it was still a Batman book. And Danny, her and Danny both made fun of me, the fact that I was sitting around reading a book, you know, which I'm like, yeah. I'm currently reading the follow-up, Batman Revolution. I'm enjoying it, but I don't think I'm enjoying it quite as much as the first one yet. But I do like it. It is of a piece. It is of, I think, of similar quality. I think just removing it just that much further from 89, although I did read an exchange between two characters that made me kind of like chuckle out loud because I could hear those two actors actually having that conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And so... So, yeah, it was a conversation between Max Schreck and Bruce Wayne. So, yeah. Between Christopher Walken and Michael Keaton. And just like, you know, Max Schreck's going off about something, and Bruce just kind of looks at him and is like, I think there's some decaf over there, you know, which is just like, that's Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne, you know. So, I was just like, oh, that's great. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I kind of, like, when I was reading that, like, I kind of had to be reminded. I was like, oh, yeah, Max Schreck is a psychopath. He's not just a greedy businessman. Like, he's had people killed. He threw his secretary out of a window.
Yeah.
Like, his whole line about being the light of Gotham City and its mean, twisted soul. I'm like, yeah, this guy is deranged. Like, so, yeah, it's definitely, he definitely captures that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he is actually nuts, and you get that he's dangerous, and yeah, yeah, and I like the fact that, you know, spoiler warning, we do get him and Selina, and so you're kind of setting up Batman Returns, since there was actually, obviously, no setup
right.
in Batman 89. They just appeared while other side characters like Alexander Knox disappeared, and of course, he's in these books as well, so. Yeah, yeah, I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much for recommending it, and it's been a great ride. I'd love to see these get adapted into a comic series or maybe an animated movie. That would be fun.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I would love that. Yeah, I'm so glad that you read the first one. That you're in the middle of the second one. So at some point, maybe we'll do more of a deeper discussion into it. I'm also glad that you finished reading Resurrection because. A plot point in terms of the villain I wanted to bring up when we get to our Batman and Robin Year One issue later on this episode. But before we get there, listeners, on the last episode, we promised you something big for our 50th celebration. And even though Batman and Robin Year One Issue 6 is really good, that's not the one we're talking about. This time we're going to cover an issue much closer to Chris's heart.
Yes, yes. We are talking about a comic that contains the greatest Batman story ever told. And I know I keep overselling this, but yes, it's at least one of the greatest Batman stories ever told. It's in the original collection of that particular book that many of us got in late 88, early 1989, and afterwards.
I've got it on my desk right next to me.
It's a seminal volume in the Franklin household. We are talking about a story in Detective Comics number 500, which had a cover date of March 1981, with an on-sale date of December 23rd, 1980. So it's one heck of a Christmas present for everybody back then. Although I will get into that I did not receive that for Christmas that year, so I will get there at some point. So we'll talk about the cover first. This double-sided cover is a jam effort by a bevy of great artists. You have Dick Giordano handling the primary images of Batman and Robin, who are looking through a magnifying glass as characters from across the history of Detective Comics leap from a slew of previous covers. You've got Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. He drew The Elongated Man. Joe Kubert drew Hawkman and Hawkgirl. Carmine Infantino drew Robin, Commissioner Gordon, and Deadman. Walt Simonson drew Batman. Jim Aparo drew Slam Bradley, Jason Bard, The Human Target, Roy Raymond TV Detective, Pow Wow Smith, Mistone the Magician, and Captain Compass. Tom Yeats drew, is that Bruce Wayne with an ascot? I guess that's who that is. And Bob Smith provided the ink. So what do you think of this cover, Ryan?
Aside from the one really significant omission, it's very fun. It's very fun. I mean, like, the back half, the part of the wraparound, I like the effect with all of the comics kind of running along the side and bottom border. But the inclusion of the other characters, like, it feels like it wants to do the thing that George Perez would eventually perfect with the Who's Who covers. Now, obviously, that was sometime after this, so it's kind of like this is kind of a proto version of that, but it's not quite there. And there's just so many of the characters are just in their civilian guises or clothes, so it's not as exciting on that second half. There's a lot of, okay, who are these guys? the first part of the cover front part, is really cool with them looking at or Batman holding the magnifying glass with the other detective characters, including Batman himself, leaping out. And while I do love me Hawkman and Hawkgirl, the fact that the Martian Manhunter is not anywhere represented on this cover, he should be in the front, but like the fact that he's nowhere to be seen is just a big miss. Like, how could you not have the Martian Manhunter?
Yeah, because he had that was his original home, was Detective Comics, right? Yeah, good point. Yeah, and we're also missing another character who probably should be on this cover, who's very important to the first story that we're going to discuss. We get Dead Man, but we don't get this other character who we'll get into. And most of you who've read this story know who I'm talking about. But yeah, I really like this. I do agree. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it being a proto Who's Who cover, but yeah, it does definitely have that kind of similar vibe. And this may be, listeners, let us know. I could be wrong. This is the first Jam cover I know of that was drawn, not like, we got to finish this cover, somebody, you inked this character, I like this cover. This was like the first intentional Jam cover where artists are drawing specific characters from the story that they drew. You know, as far as I know, this is the first one I remember. I couldn't think of another one. I'm sure, yeah, there's old examples in the Golden Age of them doing paste-ups or, we'll lift a Green Lantern Alan Scott from this cover and we'll lift a Jay Garrick from this cover, but as far as, like, creating a cover, like, literally, Dick Giordano draws the Batman and Robin and then everybody, Walt Simonson draws the little Batman and then Kubert draws Hawkman and Hawkgirl and, that type of thing. They pass it around the bullpen or mail it to each other to add to it, This is probably the first one that I know of.
Yeah, I can't think of any others like that would precede this. Or
yeah, I love the invitation masthead on funny. The title.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, it's in the vertical banner that lists all the creators involved, which is very uncommon in 1980. Yeah, yeah. So this is, I think, one of the first of the big, DC had a bunch of great anniversary issues in the 80s, and this is the first one. It doesn't have quite that trade dress that they would have anniversary up top with, like, and usually it was like had a like a fifth gold ink or something on it. Like Detective 526, yeah, which is the which is odd that it's not 527, but somebody thought the math worked out that way then and then didn't in later years. But anyway, so I don't know. But yeah, this is great. This is a great cover. So shall we pop open the cover and check out the first story inside?
Absolutely, we should.
Okay, so the first story in the comic, leading off the 500th issue of Detective Comics, is To Kill a Legend by Alan Brenner, writer, Dick Giordano, artist, Adrian Roy, colorist, John Costanza, letterer, and Paul Levitz, editor. Bruce Wayne awakens from a nightmare he hasn't had for many years, reliving the murder of his parents at the hands of gunman Joe Chill. To blow off steam, he heads out into the night as the Batman and stops a routine mugging. Chasing one of the perps down a fog-shrouded street, he finds himself deposited in the very spot his parents were killed 20 years ago, Crime Alley, which should be on the other side of Gotham. Robin swings in and KOs the fleeing mugger, despite the fact that Dick Grayson left for Europe the morning prior. The perplexed dynamic duo find their answers in the form of the Phantom Stranger who emerges from the mist. He tells them of parallel worlds and how this Batman and the Batman of Earth 2 watched their parents die decades apart. The cycle is about to repeat itself on yet another world, and the Stranger offers Batman a chance to at last prevent it. It doesn't take long for Batman to agree, but he tells an eager Robin that this is his task. But as the fog swirls around them, Robin joins anyway, knowing Bruce Wayne can't be objective about a matter so close to him. They arrive in Gotham Harbor, and while breaking up a robbery there, they learn that this world's criminals are even more cowardly and superstitious, some fainting at the mere sight of them. They also make the acquaintance of a police lieutenant, James Gordon, who has no knowledge of their existence or working relationship on Earth-1. Gordon orders them arrested, but the Cape Crusaders manage to evade the police. With minor differences between the worlds, Bruce and Dick head to the main branch of the Gotham Library for information. Bruce gets the proper address for Wayne Manor, and Dick learns there is no heroic fiction to inspire future heroes, and no red star for Krypton to orbit, meaning this world will be bereft of its own Superman. The Batman may be this Earth's only costume hero. Meanwhile, Joe Chill, on the run from a robbery gone wrong, makes his way to Gotham via train. Outside Wayne Manor, Batman and Robin observe the everyday lives of Thomas, Martha, and young Bruce. Dick notes the tantrum-prone Bruce is a brat and may grow up to become the idle playboy his Batman only pretends to be. Seeing his parents alive, Batman vows to not let them die again. To learn the whereabouts of Joe Chill, Batman disguises himself as Lieutenant Gordon and checks the GCPD's files, finding nothing on the man at all. He does, however, find the address for Lou Moxon, the man who hired Chill to kill the Waynes after Thomas testified against him in court. The masked manhunters drop in on Moxon's truck and company and wreck it, questioning Moxon himself about Joe Chill. Moxon doesn't know of Chill, but Batman threatens to return if any harm comes to the Waynes. Moxon vows to speed up his plans to murder the Doctor and find a killer to do so. Batman fears they are running out of time, it being the 21st of the month, with his parents dying on the 26th. Meanwhile, Joe Chill arrives in Gotham and plans to look up Lou Moxon for work. Batman and Robin observe the Waynes again, with the Teen Wonder pondering if they have the right to deny this world its Batman. The Dark Knight is steadfast in his mission to spare this Bruce Wayne a life of trauma. Batman leaves to see if Joe Chill has a file in the police's interstate records, and Robin spies the Waynes planning on taking Bruce to the movies, like the night they died on Otherworlds. At Police HQ, Batman finds the files that point toward Chill heading toward Gotham, but he is stopped at gunpoint by Lieutenant Gordon. Batman is able to appeal to some universal constant in Gordon, who chooses to trust him and let him go, while Robin follows the Waynes into town, still struggling if he should try and stop the inevitable. Gordon's informants lead Batman to a hotel and Joe Chill, who lays dying, rubbed out by order of Lou Moxon. Chill tells Batman his assailant was on his way to kill a doctor, and Batman realizes the Waynes are set for death that night on the 21st. On his way to Park Row, he realizes that in 20 years between his parents' death and tonight, 5 leap years had passed, essentially making this the same night. The Waynes find their film sold out, but as they try to head home, they are stopped by a man with a gun. Robin decides he can't let innocent people die, no matter the cost, but Batman beats him to it. The Cape Crusader lands in front of the Waynes and knocks the gun from the assassin's hand as he fires. He chases him down the alley, tackles him, and punches him unconscious. Their task over, the Phantom Stranger appears, with Robin asking if they'll ever know what happened to young Bruce. The heroes disappear into the fog, but they are not forgotten. 3 weeks later, young Bruce has no interest in the toy trains he was obsessed with before. He instead studies criminology books and the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The Waynes are a bit stunned by this, but Thomas jokes maybe they should get mugged more often. Outside, Bruce also trains his body, and as he walks back to his palatial home, casts a familiar Batwing shadow. So, what do you think, Ryan?
I think it's a very, very good story. I understand why you love it so much. It's an awesome comic. It's quintessential Batman in that it's got a detective story. It's got a little bit of a conflict between Batman and Robin. There's plenty of action, but there's also a personal stake and investment in Batman. You get origin story and as well as a new twist on whether Batman can affect it or not. So there's the parallel worlds, the sort of like what if type of scenario about this is really kind of an interesting touch to it. It's great. The art, Giordano's art is incredible in this one. I think my favorite part, I love the fact that independently of each other, both Robin and Batman decide they have to stop this. They can't allow innocent people to die, no matter what it might do, no matter the repercussions it might have for the future of Gotham City with regards to Batman. They can't just let history play out the way it does if it means people get hurt. And I like that they both come to that decision completely separate from each other, and that Robin is going to step in and save them, but Batman gets there first.
Yeah, that's a great bit. Yeah. In fact, this story, it feels like The City on the Edge of Forever, the classic episode of Star Trek that was initially written by Harlan Ellison and, of course, famously rewritten by Gene L. Coon and Gene Roddenberry for television production, which Harlan Ellison was not happy with, but I think that their version's better. I'm sorry. But because, you know, in that episode, Just as in this, our heroes leap through an otherworldly fog to land in a strange place, and they have to choose whether or not to change history. Will logic or emotion win out? You know, Robin is Spock and Batman is Kirk, but in this case, emotion wins, and we learn that this world will still have its Batman. I mean, the difference there is, in that one, it's literally like, okay, if we don't let Edith Keeler die, then our world will change. You know, then, you know, there'll be no bright future. There'll be no Federation. There won't be any, we won't exist. You know, so it's a little bit different stakes, of course, but it's still kind of got some of the same, you know, it's got that same moral question of, do we have the right to change the course of history? You know, the fact that the Phantom Stranger showed up and offered it to him, probably the Phantom Stranger knew things were going to work out in that way, because he seems to be the type that wants to bring balance to the universe, not, you know, not disrupt it just because it's the right thing to do, you know, necessarily. So, but yeah, I just love it. I mean, I like all the points you made about it. That's another reason I love it. And before Batman's origin was a crutch exploited on a monthly basis, Brennert used it as a wonderful device to explore the trauma that must go along with seeing your parents murdered before your eyes. I mean, trauma deep enough that it motivates your entire existence from then on. I mean, this is something that we take for granted nowadays because we've been, you know, every time, you know, you open a comic, you know, Martha Wayne's pearls go flying, you know, but that wasn't the case in 1980, right? You know, so. And I didn't actually get to read this story in Detective 500 first because somehow I missed that issue. I read it in the year's Best Comic Story Digest, Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest, number 23, a year later. I didn't get the original until a few years after that, I think at a flea market or something. And I think this is probably the first time I ever saw or read Batman's origin. I mean, the first few pages of this, you know, you get Batman's origin as Bruce dreams it, but I missed the Untold Legend of the Batman miniseries. I saw the ads, I didn't get it. And I didn't read that until I got the Tor paperback, little novel-sized paperback in 1982. So, yeah, I mean, so this is like, not only is this a fantastic story, but I learned Batman's origin from this story. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's seminal, you know?
Yeah, I read this in the Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told collection, which I got in, I think we talked about before. I got it in either, I think, 1990, maybe 91. It was pretty early on, so it was one of the first comics that I was reading around, one of the first Batman comics that I was reading. So, but by that point, I had seen the movie, which had its version of the origin story, too.
Right.
So this was the first time I saw the origin with somebody other than the Joker killing Thomas Hardaway.
You're like, that's not right.
Or no, I'd read year one in Dark Knight Returns first.
Yeah. So. If you did encounter Batman first in Batman 89 and then you start reading comics, who's this Joe Chill or this no-name gunman? Who's this guy?
Really?
Yeah, it's like the Joker killed Batman's parents, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This, of course, was also reprinted in Tales of the Batman, Alan Brennert, which I think is amazing. Alan Brennert's only written a handful of comic stories, and most of them for DC, but they're all reprinted in this nice hardcover, and some of them aren't really Batman stories. There's the Black Canary origin from Secret Origins number 50, which you covered on Secret Origins.
Yep.
And there's the infamous Dead Man Supergirl story from the Christmas with the Superheroes, but most of them are Batman stories, of course. But he said in the intro, Alan Brennert said in the intro to that book, that he mentioned the idea for this story to his old fanzine friend, Paul Levitz. They both come up making fanzines. And Paul was the Batman editor at the time. And he was writing for television. He was a story editor on the Wonder Woman TV series. And he had, wrote the plot for a comic with his friend Martin Pascow for a Wonder Woman issue. But he hadn't completely written a comic yet. So he pitched this idea to Paul Levitz, with the idea of him getting one of his Batman writers to, you know, to flesh it out and into a script. And Paul Levitz says, well, why don't you write it? And he's like, okay. So he wrote it and thought, oh, it'll be a fill-in issue somewhere, you know, down the line. And he had no idea it was going to be the lead story in the 500th issue of Detective Comics.
Quite a vote of confidence from Paul Levitz.
Yeah. Well, you know, he probably took one look at it and said, oh my God, you know, I just got the issue, the story for Detective number 500. And Alan Brenner also mentions how he loved to use parallel worlds as a device, since it was a great way to delve deeper into the characters than an average story would allow. And I know Shag is going to moan and groan if he listened to the show, which I know he doesn't. But this is when DC killed the multiverse, they killed the potential for stories like this. I mean, right or wrong, when they said, nope, no more parallel worlds, you could have never done this story. After, you know, I mean, well, Alan Brennert was still kind of skirting that with some of the stories he wrote, but you weren't supposed to, right? So, yeah, I think that's, you know, again, this is another one of those cases where they didn't do that type of thing. Yes, there was an Earth 2 that we already knew about that, you know, was featured in some DC comics pretty regularly, you know, but the idea of doing other parallel worlds, and yeah, yes, there was Earth S and Earth X and all that stuff, but the idea of using it for a very personal story like this was unique, I think. You know, and I think that's a potential. It didn't have to be a world-shattering crisis. It could just be, well, Batman just wants to save his parents from getting killed, you know.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, and that's at the heart of the character, obviously. And it was a great device to use it that way. So
right, because the weight of that event, and, well, that's what this whole story is about, the weight of that event, that impact on history for Bruce and for Batman and Robin, everything like that. That is a earth-changing crisis, sort of like that.
Yeah,
like it would affect their world and the stories.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. In some ways, it does, and I think it's interesting that, you know, that this world doesn't have any heroic literature, although it does have Sherlock Holmes, apparently, which is like, that's kind of heroic literature. But, you know, he says it doesn't have any Camelot, no Odysseus, you know, no Robin Hood, things like that. So it's like, you know, Batman really would be like the first heroic figure in a lot of ways. And there's no chance of Superman because which I think it's interesting that Dick can go to the library and find, well, there's the star where Krypton's supposed to orbit, which is, I mean, you know, why not? I mean, you know, in the DC universe, why not? But, yeah, it's, you brought up earlier the artwork by Dick Giordano. I think this might be his best artwork in a Batman story. I mean, I know there's no hope in Crime Alley. That's wonderful, fantastic. But I don't know. I just feel like he was like, I don't know. Maybe he understood how special this was and like just gave it an extra polish or something. The character, the figure work just looks so perfect. And in my mind's eye, in a lot of ways, this is what Batman and Robin look like. You know, yeah, it's got that same kind of feel of Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. It's got that kind of style guidey look to them. They look just completely on model.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of next door or in between Jose and Jim Aparo in a few panels. I kind of get that sense. But yeah, definitely like, they're model perfect, I would say, kind of everybody here.
Yeah. I think that splash page where you've got Batman, you know, you've got the figure of Batman and his cape is enveloping his origin. I think if I had to own, like you can own one comic book page, that might be the one I go for. Because, I mean, you've got a great figure of Batman and you've got his origin all in one image. It's, you know, and I guess in some ways it's kind of the modern version of that, when they did the Batman origin from Batman number one and they put the figure of Batman, it was from like, was it Detective 33, I think. But they took it was Batman fighting the Dirigible of Doom in that one, but they had the figure of Batman and then the panels around him with the origin, you know, it's kind of a modern take on that, or well, a 1980 take on that. It's a 46 year old story, but you know, So, interestingly, Batman hasn't dreamed about his parents' murders since he caught Joe Chill. So, Earth One Batman doesn't see his parents die every time he closes his eyes.
Well, that's not the Batman I love.
Yeah. He's way too well-balanced and middly healthy. Yeah. I will say that Robin's pun about the Goodrich blimp when he shows up, he's like, look, the Goodrich blimp. And the guy looks up and he punches him and he says, idiot, there's no, the Goodrich doesn't have a blimp or whatever. That has stuck with me because anytime I see Goodrich, which is a brand like Goodyear.
Yeah.
I always think that, yo, they don't have a blimp. yeah. And Dick Giordano draws a great Dick Grayson Robin. He's very mature looking, much like George Perez is getting ready to do in New Teen Titans, you know, and several artists. I mean, Jim Aparo drew him older looking too, but he looks like he's, you know, too old for his costume. So, but he still looks good. And then of course we get the appearance of the Phantom Stranger. You know, I know Rob, our buddy Rob Kelly, is a huge Phantom Stranger fan, and I've always liked the character too. You know, I just like that he shows up and a lot of times doesn't really do a lot. When he's in these team-ups anyway, he kind of offers the characters a chance to do something or gives them a little bit of information. He's like a more active version of the Watcher in some ways when it comes to team-ups. But what do you think of the Phantom Stranger?
I like him. I think back when I was doing Midnight the Podcasting Hour, I talked about it on a couple episodes. Like, he's very cool looking, and I like the idea of him. Sometimes the execution is a little bit frustrating because sometimes I think part of the nature of comics, and I think Grant Morrison phrased this better, but like comics are about characters in action. You need them to be doing stuff. And the Phantom Stranger is often, in stories like this, he's used as a frame, as a catalyst for other events, but we don't see him being proactive or active as often. Again, it's one of those things. I like the idea of the character, but seeing him in stories, seeing him, how he's used, sometimes depends.
I think the thing with him is like you never know how powerful is he, you know. And I mean, a lot of characters dial that up and down, like with the Spectre. You know, sometimes he's powerful enough that you know he can fight the Anti-Monitor, and other times he, you know, he's just happy with turning people into candles and lighting them on fire and letting them melt. You know, but. But, you know, with the Phantom Stranger, it's like, you know, and then they had in his title, they had Dr. 13 trying to debunk whether or not he had any powers at all or was just some charlatan. So it's like, obviously he can open portals into other worlds here. So, he's got, you know, he's got some power, obviously, but, I like it when he shows up. I like when he's used as a device. You know, I've read some of the, Len Wein, Jim Aparo comics that Rob, you know, covered in his blog he did years ago. And I enjoy those a lot, but I do kind of like it when he's kind of that unofficial, kind of official, unofficial Justice League member because he never really said yes or no. So I will say this is interesting, just popped in my head because, of course, we've always talked about, you know, when you read these, especially Bronze Age Batman comics and moving forward, many of us hear Kevin Conroy in our head. You know, from Batman the Animated Series and all the DCAU and the Arkham games and everything. But Kevin Conroy also voiced the Phantom Stranger on the Brave and the Bold episode, Chill of the Night, where it's got some similarities to this story in some ways. I mean, Batman doesn't go to a parallel world, but him and the Spectre set Batman on a path to find Joe Chill. And then it kind of adapts that story where he hunts down Joe Chill. So if you want to, you can like hear Kevin Conroy twice in your head.
And the follow-up, the Spectre's voice in that episode was Mark Hamill, who did the Joker in the animated series. So.
Yeah, and he was a great Spectre. He sounded very sinister. Yeah. There was definitely a, you know, little angel, little devil thing going on in that episode. And the Phantom Stranger was the angel, and the Spectre was most definitely the devil on his shoulders. So. I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, Phantom Stranger knew Batman did need Robin there, even if ultimately he doesn't listen to him at all. You know, so Robin goes there to be Batman's Jiminy Cricket in some ways. And, you know, but in the end, like you said, Robin also says, oh, I can't let people die. So it's kind of, you know, it is, you know, Batman, I think he just needed Robin there for, you know, moral support, you know, even though Robin was, you know, challenging him through it. So, and then, you know, it's also interesting because, as we mentioned, I guess because there's no heroic fiction, that's one of the reasons why the criminals that they fight on the docks just faint at the sight of them, some of them. So there's nothing that, I don't know, they just didn't, it's like they've never seen anything like that before. It's kind of an interesting take. We meet Commissioner Gordon, Lieutenant Gordon, not Commissioner yet. And we meet his fiance, Barbara Keene, at the library, of course, filling in the job that her daughter will take, at least on Earth One at some point. And Brennert was the guy who gave Gordon's wife that name. You know, Barbara was used as, that was her name in Batman Year One. They used it on the series Gotham, which I think was, there was some consternation about he didn't get credit or any kind of compensation for that at first. And I think eventually they worked something out because, you know, everybody else was getting compensated for things. But yeah, he definitely was the one that, that's Commissioner Gordon's wife's name. So she's Barbara the First, I guess. So. And I assume they broke into a store and left money for street clothes because Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson are in their, you know, casual attire going to the library. What do you think?
I mean, considering like what, when they can take a mask off and they've got the full cowl and hat and everything, like I have no problem believing that they've got a full 3-piece suit on underneath the Batman suit.
I remember there was one episode of Batman 66 where they had Bruce. I think it was a season 3 one. It was kind of like The Flash. They had their costumes in little capsules. Then when they put them in water, they expanded into full, you know. So it's, I mean, pretty much like Barry Allen's Flash ring, you know. So maybe like Superman compresses Clark Kent's clothes down and puts them in his pocket of his cape. Maybe he made a suit for Batman and Robin. Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson outfits for him, and so they could put him in their cape. You know, I got to think about things like that when you're doing a podcast. You think of these things. So this is, of course, when they go to the library, they learn where, you know, Wayne Manor's address is. It might be slightly different. They mention some streets are, you know, Basin Street is Basin Avenue, things like that. And they also find out, Dick finds out, no heroic literature, no star for Krypton. And we get interstitials with Joe Chill throughout this, which I like because it feels like it's leading up to something. Like, oh, here's Joe Chill. You know, he's on a bus. He's heading to Gotham because he was involved in a robbery gone wrong. Then Brennert swerves and, like, kills Joe Chill, which you're like, what?
Right, yeah. But when he introduced him, it sets up the ticking clock. Like, I mean, that just naturally ramps up the tension. We know Joe Chill kills their parents, so as soon as we see him, it's like, okay, they're on borrowed time. Like, what's going to happen? Like, every time we see him, it's like we're getting closer and closer, and it's just ramping it up.
Yeah, that was a very cinematic device. I feel like that felt like a movie or a TV show would do, and like, you know, here's this actor again appearing on screen as Joe Chill. It just kind of felt like that. So, yeah, it was great. So what did you think of young Bruce being a brat?
Not surprising. I mean, I guess maybe in the world, like the child of a billionaire turning out to be kind of a shithead? Yeah, that doesn't seem that surprising.
Yeah, that's true. He's like throwing toy trains across the room because it's not the one he wanted. You know, it's like, wow. I like that Thomas is going for a smack. You know, he's got his hand raised. And we've seen, you know, in modern comics, Thomas Wayne sometimes portrayed as he was known to get a little abusive sometimes, little, you know, both mentally and physically. Not horribly, I don't think, but still, he could be an overly stern father that some people would frown upon, you know, nowadays. But yeah. I will not question, just like we're not going to question where they got their suits. I will not question if Batman has enough disguise equipment in his utility belt to pull off Lieutenant Gordon. So we're just going to, he just can, you know, it's the Bronze Age. And like you said, rubber masks over cowls. That's just part of the universe back then.
I really like that panel where he's walking off it, like almost smiling with the pipe as Jim Gordon, because you can tell it's a little bit off from what we saw of Jim earlier, but it's got the same jawline. Like, Giordano, like, knows the technique well enough. Maybe that's why my brain went to like the Jim Aparo thing, because I think of like these sort of very defined facial features so that you can always tell it's Bruce Wayne, even if he's wearing a cowl or a different mask or something. But I get the same thing from here. I was like, yeah, that's Bruce Wayne dressed up as somebody with a fake, you know, glasses, hair and stuff like that. I can still see him underneath that. And that's, you know, credit to the art.
Yeah, he kind of looks alike with the brown hair. He looks a little like Matches Malone, honestly, and the mustache. He's just got a pipe, not a match, you know. But, yeah, there are a couple of panels in this comic where Giordano draws Batman. Jim Aparo got to where he drew the shadows on Batman's mask the same almost every time he drew him, like from almost every angle. And there's a couple of panels in here that very much look like, you know, Jim Aparo type Batman panels. I definitely see where you're seeing that. I definitely get that. One minor niggle here, though, about this story, and I didn't think that 2 years later. And I have covered this on other podcasts. I think on a very early episode of Supermates, Cindy and I talked about this, I think with Rob, because Rob is actually friends with Alan Brennard. He's gotten to be friends with him over the years. But Batman finds out where Lou Moxon is. And, of course, in the Earth One continuity, Lou Moxon, you know, he came in, he was injured, he came into the party that the Waynes were attending where Thomas was dressed up as a Batman, and he asked, you know, Thomas to fix him up, and he ends up, you know, turning on him and fighting them, and Moxon gets arrested, and then Moxon swears revenge, and he's the one that hires Chill to kill the Waynes, so... and that comes out later after Batman's tracked Chill down and, you know, everything. But what if Lou Moxon in this universe was actually running a legitimate trucking company now? Because Batman and Robin just show up, crash through the skylight, and blow the place up. I mean, they literally just, they grab a truck and, like, Batman drives it into some oil cans. It blows up. It's a great action sequence. And, yes, the guys pull guns on them. But, you know, they're literally broke into their place. So, you know, if they pulled guns on them, they were trying to defend themselves, maybe. You know, we know. He even says, you know, I got to move up my timetable, blah, blah, blah. So we know he's intending to kill Thomas Wayne. But what if he wasn't? You know?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. You know.
Actually, this is Lou Moxon's supervillain origin story caused by Batman to, you know, persecuting him unfairly.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, I was going to let that Wayne guy go. Now I got to kill him. You know, because yeah. Like, Batman's like, leave the Waynes alone. You know, so like, yeah. Oh, yeah. They don't establish the month the Waynes are killed, do they? They just say it's the 26th, but they don't say the month, which I'm sure it's been established at some point what actual date it was, but then it's probably been contradicted, so I don't
right.
know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, of course, like we said, they, you know, Batman and Robin through several of these scenes have this, you know, argument of whether they should, you know, let history, you know, take its course, and Robin's worried that Bruce will be an idle playboy and the Earth will have no hero in Batman. But it's odd to see them switch roles, because usually nowadays we see that Robin, Dick Grayson, is a very passionate character. And in fact, we'll see that in our next issue we're going to talk about this episode.
Yeah, we will.
Because Dick gets very passionate with Bruce, who does seem sometimes very cold and calculating, especially in modern interpretations. So it's interesting to see that Dick is being very logical, again, like Spock, and Batman's, it's pure emotion. You know, I cannot let my parents die. And you can't blame him, of course. But I just think that's another interesting angle to take the story in, that, you know, Brennard gives adds some depth here. And I'm not saying the characters didn't have depth in the Bronze Age. They did. But it takes it to that next level because, again, the stories just never seemed very personal back then. And this really does, you know. The marquee on the movie theater makes it look like they're taking Bruce to see Annie Hall.
Yep, Diane Keaton.
Yeah. How appropriate is that for an 8 to 10 year old? I mean, it was rated PG, but I mean, everything was rated PG back then and had boobs. You know, I mean, there were movies that you go see a PG movie and oh, there's naked breasts, and you know, back then. So
this Bruce Wayne would forever associate his parents' death with Woody Allen.
Yes, he would. Yeah. So what did you think about the scene where Gordon decides to trust Batman?
I wish they could have done more with it, or I wish he had stretched it out, or I wish there had been more of a intellectual plea or something. Like, I don't know. Like, it goes by so quickly, and it's just kind of like Gordon just like accepts it. He's like, all right, the vibes I'm getting from this guy dressed as a bat are okay. So I'm going to let him go. I'm not going to arrest him, even though he's breaking in. And that's, I want to either do more with it, or that could have been cut out. I thought that part was a little bit weak. I like that we got a moment between Batman and this version of Gordon, because maybe this would have had a profound impact on Gordon the way it has on the Waynes, but we don't get enough of that. And I just, if you were going to do something with that, do something with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say, you know, just from a purely, you know, clinical as a podcaster examining stories, I do feel you're right. I do feel like I wish they'd given us more to go on than just it does feel like the reason that he trusts him is literally because the universe says that Batman and Jim Gordon have to be allies. You know, it's like the, you know, it's like one of those fixed points in all universes, it's an anchor point type thing. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like he's some universal constant is speaking to him in that moment. Like you said, I think it could have been fleshed out, but I mean, you know, he had 20 pages, and I think he does, you know, it works, but yeah, if you examine it too much, maybe doesn't work quite as well, but you know, the beat's great. And plus now we know based on the ending, if Bruce does indeed, little Bruce grows up to be Batman, you know, he's going to have an ally, and Gordon's like, hey, I remember you, you know. He might be like, wait a minute, shouldn't you be older now? But anyway, yeah, he'll keep to the shadows and just act like he's the same Batman, maybe.
I haven't seen you in like 15 years. Where you been?
Yeah, where the hell you been? What you been doing? Yeah. So Moxon ordered Chill dead because of Batman asking about him. And Batman doesn't seem the least bit torn up about that, does he?
He's got other stuff on his mind.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, Joe Chill always ends up getting killed by the criminal element. I mean, he, you know, when he Batman caught up to him in the classic, you know, Earth One's tale, he, you know, he's like, this guy said I, you know, Batman showed up and said I created him. Like, you created Batman, and his guys just all shoot him, you know. So I think I love that. That's so such a great bit. That's Bill Finger's story, yay. So like we said, despite his protest, Dick couldn't let the Waynes just die. But I'm glad Batman gets to save the day, of course. You don't want Robin stopping the Wayne murder, you want Batman stopping the Wayne murder.
Right. It's gotta be.
Yeah, it's a great bit too. I love the concentric circles as Batman tackles the gunman. That's a nice bit. There's some great little, you know, this story is just, you know, there's a lot of dynamic panels and little effects here and there. I love the fact that, you know, the shot of Batman punching the guy, he's outside the frames of the other panels. He's like, you know, standing outside of that. That's a nice little touch. So. And I love the last page, of course. And now I can't read it without hearing the slow melodic version of the BTS theme, you know,
as we see Bruce
casting that shadow, you know. Dun, 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 dun. And, oh, man, why hasn't somebody adapted this into something? You know, why wasn't this an episode of Batman the Animated Series or The Brave and the Bold? Or, you know, it would have been perfect. You know, I wish they had done that. So, yeah.
I like that as soon as Batman takes out the killer or the would-be killer, Phantom Stranger shows up again. And he's like, all right, don't stick around. Don't dilly-dally. You're out of here. You made your decision. It's like,
yeah.
Like, back to Earth One with you.
Yeah, I can't let you stick around and mess up the timeline. You
know? Right.
It's like one of those bus trips, you know, where you're like, you've got like just those, like you can go to the Salem Witch Museum for like 10, you know, 15 minutes, and then you got to get back on the bus. You know, it's it's like that, one of those things. Yeah. It's and thankfully, and I looked this up, and if I'm wrong, listeners, let me know. No one has ever ruined this story by writing a sequel to it. just leave it alone, folks, and let us imagine what this Batman is like. You can't do it justice, so don't. Unless Alan Prendert decides to write it himself, don't let... We'll just imagine that this guy grows up to be, you know, a very happy, healthy Batman, and we'll call it good, so...
Oh, man. If Dan Didio had heard that, he would have been like, nah, bullshit. I'll make a sequel to it.
I want to go back and make him be like he wants to kill the entire universe, you know, like Superboy Prime, you know. That, you know, just like, it's a god. I will say, though, I kind of thought in my head there was, I think it was in Legends of the DC Universe. Remember that title? It was like Legends of the Dark Knight, but it was like it rotated with different characters. There was an issue about Crisis on Infinite Earths that Marv Wolfman wrote. And I want to think, did like Paul Ryan or somebody draw it? I can't remember. But there was like, it was like a missing chapter of Crisis on Infinite Earths. And there was a Earth where like the heroes were much, it was like a more of a squeaky clean version of the Justice League, wherever it was like, They were from different, like, they were different ethnicities and stuff. It was like, it was more like a perfect kind of world where everybody, you know, got along and everything. And there was a Batman there, and Robin was his son. And in the back of my head, I'm like, well, maybe that's this Bruce Wayne, because he's very, you know, well adjusted. So, but apparently it wasn't supposed to be. But I remember thinking that, like, is he Alan Brennert's little Bruce Wayne? I don't know, but I don't think he is. I know some of you are probably going to like, this is not the greatest Batman story ever told. This is the greatest Batman story ever told. Well, tell us what's the greatest Batman story ever told in the feedback. Let us know. What do you think of this story? It's definitely in that book. Actually, Alan Brennert's got two Batman stories, because he's got that and the autobiography of Bruce Wayne, the how Batman and Catwoman of Earth 2, you know, ended up like falling in love and getting married in that same volume. And the guy had written like, I don't know, five comic stories by that point. And two of them got in there. And he wrote my personal favorite comic story of all time, which is Batman, Brave and the Bold number 182 with Batman and the Earth 2 Robin. So... which there may be something more coming up about that soon. I don't know how soon, because what I'm doing is taking me way longer than I anticipated. But keep your podcatchers and your ears open for something on that. But
all will be revealed.
All will be revealed. And the Phantom Stranger will appear to you and come out of the fog and tell you what's going on. No, I'm just kidding. I love this. Obviously, I love this story. I feel like it's just a little masterpiece of a comic story, and particularly a Batman story. And I'm glad we got to talk about it. Thank you for indulging my mania for it.
It had to be. I knew we were going to get to this one, so this was a ton of fun. I do really. I don't have the same nostalgia for it, and I don't have the same attachment to it that you do, but I also don't have anything bad to say about it. It's just, like you said, it's a great masterpiece comic.
Yeah. I think part of it, too, is because when I probably read this not long after I really could read, you know, and was, like, reading comics on my own. And so this was like, oh, comics can be this, too? You know, like, they can make me feel things, you know? Even at 6 years old, I'm like, I understand, you know, like, I kind of understand how all this would make me feel, you know, and maybe it's because I was a kid like little Bruce, you know, that was part of it too, you know. So, but yeah, I think that's another thing that it hit at just the right time to make me think, yo, comics don't have to be just, you know, let's stop this bad guy and let's punch them. They can be something very personal like this.
That was my reaction the first time I saw a Jim Ballant Catwoman comic.
This comic touches me, or it makes me want to touch. Never mind. No.
Alrighty, folks. We're going to take a quick promo break. When we come back, we'll have the best Batman story ever told. We'll have to get them. We will return to our coverage of Batman and Robin Year One. Stick around.
Maybe I can do a podcast about comic books. No, everybody does a podcast about comic books. Maybe I can do a podcast about TV shows. There's a lot of podcasts out there covering TV shows. I know a podcast about movies. It's too general. A lot of people do podcasts about movies. Star Wars movies. No, everybody talks about Star Wars movies. I need to do a podcast that covers movies and television shows and comics and all the pop culture I loved growing up. Wait a minute. The Pop Culture Basement Podcast, hosted by me, Mike Jamison, covering all of the pop culture that I consumed and that we consumed during our formative years. Now available on all reputable podcast platforms. Join us down in the basement.
Who's editing? A thought experiment in which Siskoid and his guest appoint themselves editors of a comic book line at DC Comics. But the joke's on them, because they can only use the characters of a specific issue of Who's Who, and in fact must use them. Great ideas? Yes, we think so. Cool reinventions? Of course. Crisis fatigue? We guarantee it. Who's editing? Now on its own feed, only at the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Révolution, économie,
révélation. Batman and Robin Year One Issue 6 came out on March 19th, 2025. The story is by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, with Waid scripting and Samnee drawing. Matthias Lopez colored the book, Clayton Cowles lettered it with Chris Samnee, Andrew Marino and Rob Levin edited the thing. The cover is a straight-ahead shot of Robin walking a tightrope with eyes closed toward the reader. The background, however, is split with a shot of Haley Circus to his right and Gotham City to his left. What do you think about this cover?
Oh, I think it's a fantastic image. It just now occurred to me, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Batman Year 3 and Lonely Place of Dying covers that George Perez did. Because there was a lot of that symbolism between, like, Dick Grayson's life as a circus acrobat and then his life as Robin and Nightwing. And so it kind of reminds me of that a little bit. But I love the little detail of Bruce appearing in the crowd in the circus scene. And then Batman is parallel to that on the Gotham side of things. So I love that. If you blink, you'll miss that. Sammy's really good at these little Easter eggs in the visuals. I love it.
Yeah, and the dual color sets of, like, the red with the circus and the blue, the cold blue with the city skyline and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic.
And the cover is actually kind of thematic to what we see inside.
Yes, it actually matches what's going on inside.
Inside the book, Batman recalls how Dick Grayson came to be his partner in crime fighting as he frantically searches for his missing sidekick. A note left at Robin's abandoned motorcycle points Batman to General Grimaldi. The general can't convince Robin to reveal any intel on the Dark Knight, but he does convince one of his underlings the futility of unmasking Robin at that moment. Batman sneaks into Grimaldi's building, where he finds a secret and very extensive chemical laboratory where scientists are conducting some kind of genetic experiments on captive patients. The latest test subject morphs into a giant, hulking, and suicidal monstrosity who accidentally blows up the lab, causing a massive fire in the building. Batman races up floor after floor looking for Robin, feeling more desperate with every flight of stairs. Of course, he need not have worried, because while Batman was breaking in, Robin was slipping his ropes and escaping Grimaldi's building via a tightrope walk to the next closest building. Back at the Batcave, Bruce lectures Dick on what his recklessness cost them in the war on crime. Finally, Dick explodes, countering Bruce's criticisms with a defense of not just his athletic prowess, but his burning need to fight evil and bring justice and safety to the people of Gotham. Bruce recognizes the same anger that drives his own mission and realizes that he has as much to learn from Dick as the boy from him. Elsewhere in the city, Grimaldi sets up his new base of operations when he gets a visit from Two-Face. The former DA brings a gift for the general, the file he stole from Commissioner Gordon's office way back in Issue 1. We finally find out what that file is and why Gordon didn't want Batman to know its contents. The file is the police investigation into the Batman and his secret identity. All right, what did you think about this one?
Well, this is another great issue where Mark Waid really puts across why Batman needs Robin and why Robin needs Batman and why they both do what they do. And I didn't even think about how nicely this ties into the comic we just talked about, but in a lot of ways it does. Because it's, you know, it gets to the heart of the characters and their motivations. This particular issue really does. And there's an exchange here. This is kind of like this. I mean, I was loving this book anyway, but this issue kind of cemented like, oh yes, I love the way Mark Waid's handling these characters.
Yeah.
And it's we'll get to it, but yeah, it's a great issue.
We've been saying this since we came back with Batman and Superman World's Finest, number one. Mark Waid's grasp of Robin, Dick Grayson in particular, and like his handle on that character is just so good. And like every issue just unravels more about why he knows this character and why this character should be there, has to be there, is relevant. And yeah, we get like the title sequence, the credits page with a recap of the death of the Flying Graysons and the traumatic event that kind of forged Dick Grayson on his path. On the second page, we get that shot that you're kind of alluding to with Bruce Wayne standing up because he's in the crowd and he's realizing what happened. Do we know the name of the woman sitting next to him? She's illustrated kind of with purple hair, but I'm not sure. Like, was that Julie Madison, or like, did he have a date to the circus that we knew about? Like, who was named ever?
Well, Julie Madison was his girlfriend during that period in the original comics, because she was in the stories with the monk, and then she was in the Clayface story after Robin first appeared just a few issues later. So, yeah, I would assume it's Julie Madison.
She was blonde, wasn't she?
No, she was brunette. Okay. And Linda Page was blonde.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Julie Madison's usually portrayed as brunette. She's, you know, black-haired, whatever, you know. So, yeah, it does look a little purpley, but it's kind of hard to tell with the coloring, you know, in that flashback. So, yeah. I was thinking it was Julie Madison, yeah.
We see the shot of the back of Dick Grayson as he's still mourning his parents, with Bruce extending his hand, and the next thing, Dick has taken his hand, but now it's the gloved hand of Batman as they're doing the solemn candlelight vow to, you know, fight crime that we do from Robin's first appearance.
Yeah, I never get tired of seeing that image. I love it. Alex Ross did a painting of I think it was for Legend of the Dark Knight number 100, which told another version of how Batman, you know, Robin's origin, basically. Mm-hmm. And I've got a print of that actually up on my in my collectibles room. Dick's taking the vow, and there's a great shot of Robin behind it. Yeah, and I love that, and I love the fact that the shot of Dick with his parents' bodies in the spotlight is very much like the cover of Batman number 404, year one, but it's just reversed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just reversed.
His parents' bodies. Yeah.
Yeah. It's from the back instead of from the front.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, great catch. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. I like that little bit. And of course, you know, there's a lot of Mazzucchelli in Chris Samnee's art.
That's throughout. Yeah.
Yeah.
We see Batman, you know, he's racing in the Batmobile, and you see kind of like the dread on his face in that second panel. And I like that at this moment, he's ahead of Alfred. Alfred is like communicating to him frantically what's going on, but Alfred is a step behind. And that's kind of like, oh yeah, like Bruce is already like going into overcharge mode to try and get his guy back. So,
yeah, that's a great bet. Yeah. I like that. You know, there's a post-it note waiting for him too on the bat cycle. Yeah. I also like the fact that even the seats in the Batmobile look like Batman's profile. That's a nice touch. They've got bat ears.
That is amazing. I didn't catch it. Yeah. Oh, that's good. We go to Grimaldi's office where he's got Robin tied up, kind of continuing what he was saying before, using him as bait for the Batman. He knows he's not going to get any intel, but he's trying anyway.
And I love how Robin, how put out Robin looks as he's looking at him in that panel where it reveals him. He just looks so like he's just like done with these guys already. Yeah. He's not scared. He's just put out.
And Robin isn't going to give him anything, but he's trying to get information from him. So even as he's the one tied up, he's like, we know, he's like, why are you turning all of Gotham's mobs against each other? And Grimaldi's like, yeah, it keeps them busy and off the streets. You're welcome, by the way, is like sort of sarcastically. And Robin just goes, hilarious. You kind of get the emphasis in the lettering of that second syllable.
Yeah, I love that bit.
And then this great little moment where one of his hoods is like, yeah, kid's got a smart mouth, and he's about to pull off Dick's domino mask. And Grimaldi stops him, and you disappoint me. There are over 100,000 boys his age in Gotham. How many can you identify purely on sight? Perfect.
Like, yep, that's what I brought that up last time, mm-hmm. You know, and so they addressed it. They're like, yeah, they could unmask him. It's like that episode of Justice League Unlimited. That,
exactly.
You know, with the Luthor and Flash switch bodies, and Lex pulls his mask off, looks at Wally West in the mirror and says, I have no idea who this is.
Exactly. Like with Bruce Wayne, it would be one thing. With Clark Kent, it would be one thing. It's like, but nobody knows who these guys are. It's a kid, yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, Bruce has no trouble finding little black-haired kids all the time that fit into the same costume. So clearly there are 100,000 of these potential Robins in Gotham.
Yeah, if they got red hair, just dye it black. You know, it's like...
We get a return of the Mazzucchelli-style bat glider.
Yes.
This time, however, Batman is not flying it. He's using it as a distraction as it soars through the night and crashes through the window. And the goons unload their guns on it. But, of course, it's a fake because Batman is sneaking in the building a different way.
I love the one goon's like, it's just a big effing kite, you know, basically. It's like it's the bat kite, you know. No, it's like the hang glider. But yeah, I think it's funny that it like they think it's a kite, you know. It's like I've had several Batman kites in my time, so you know I could see that.
In the scene, the sort of middle panel where Batman is sneaking through the rooms, I love that there's like a little like his face is blown up by like the beaker or the, you know, Bunsen burner, whatever it is, like the vial or whatever, like kind of was that effect, the effect of the glass kind of makes his face look bigger. So we get a close up shot.
Yeah. Distorts it, like magnifies it. Yeah. It reminds me of something like from a Peter Cushing Frankenstein movie. That's kind of, yeah. Like, he's walking past it, you know, and it's what it kind of reminds me of. Yeah.
And then we get this whole little sequence where Bruce kind of finds out, he's like, okay, this is what Grimaldi's been up to, or this is one of the things he's been up to. They're injecting these unwitting test subjects with this kind of toxin or something, and it's having these freak. And like the first time I was like, okay, is it venom? But then once the guy kind of blew up and turns into this hulking monster, so maybe it was just something in the zeitgeist, but between this and Batman Resurrection, which you just read, and also the Black Label series Batman First Night, which I love and which Martin Gray recommended we cover. They're just doing a lot with Batman and the Monster Men. Like, that story's coming back a lot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, I kind of felt like, is this kind of like is this like a cross between Venom and the Monster Man?
Yeah.
You know, because like, it seems like it could be, you know, without, you know, giving away anything, it could seem like it could be potentially something to do with Venom, like, you know, an early encounter, or it could be, you know, something to do with Hugo Strange and the Monster Man and then Bruce Timm did the little Batman 75th anniversary short with Hugo Strange and the Monster Men, and which kind of led into the Batman Cape Crusader animated series that was on last year, or maybe it was a year before now. It's been forever since that was on, but yeah, it's kind of back around a lot. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Maybe everybody's just like, we've done the Riddler to death. What else we got?
right. Yes.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just this guy like kind of gets up. He knocks into the lamp and starts this fire, and the scientists are trying to evacuate and trying to call Grimaldi to get everybody out.
Yeah, yeah, It's a nice, I mean, the guy is really, it's really disturbing looking what he looks like, because he's like misshapen and he's got one huge eyeball and it's just all veins, and it's very David Cronenberg body horror, you know, right, type thing going on. Yeah.
And then an interesting moment from Grimaldi, based on like what we've seen in the previous couple of issues, his goon tells him, it's like, okay, there's a fire, the lab is destroyed, we got to get everybody out. And he's like, all right, tell the men to catch Batman if they can, but prioritize my father's safety. And then the blaze. Salvage the files and the computers, anything that can get that can be tied to us, then abandon the site. So he's thinking tactically. He's like, all right, we're not going to try and fight this one out if we don't have to. Get everybody out of there. But the fact that he mentions prioritize my father's safety, it's like, okay, is that out of love, or is that because he still wants to prove a point to the man before he dies?
I kind of feel it's that one. I could be wrong, and maybe he really loves the guy more than he lets on. He wants to act like he doesn't, because, you know, he's a complex guy, I think, this General Grimaldi. Yeah. And I like how he's like pretty calm about everything too. You know, it's like, he's got his hands in his pockets. Like, he's just like, damn it. He's not like, damn it. You know, he's not like railing or screaming. It's a nice, you know, he's a very cool, collected type guy for the most part. So I like that bit.
And then Robin, with no trouble at all, slips out of his ropes and just kind of sits there triumphantly, almost doffs his cap with like imaginarily. And he goes, next time, try tying up someone who hasn't trained with Dibny the Contortionist. What did you think about that reference?
I like it. I do like it. I'm sure some people probably think, oh, you make the universe so small by making everyone know everyone and everyone trained with everyone, you know. So it's like, you know, that's the Roy Thomas, everyone who can be related must be related kind of trope to a point. But Dick and Ralph Dibny are both from the circus, so I think it works. And plus, you know, it's a tie back to another character who was in Detective Comics, you know, and it was in the Detective Comics issue we talked about just a minute ago. But he had a backup in Detective Comics in the 60s and in the 70s, and obviously has, you know, teamed up with Batman, both Justice League members. So yeah, I like that bit.
Me too. I mean, also part of it is I just wonder if that was something that Mark Waid had wanted to do for a while, because I know how much he loves the character, going back to when he was co-writing 52 with the other guys. He really loved writing Ralph and Sue. Or Sue wasn't in it, but like Sue's ghost eventually. So we get another moment where Batman is fighting this hulking monster, trying to subdue him, trying to actually like not just kill or destroy this thing, but get it to calm down enough that he can save it, that he can come up with an antidote or a cure to get him to restore his humanity. Of course, it's not working. The guy's freaking out too much, and a couple of, catalytic chemicals engage with each other, and big ol' explosion.
Yeah. I did like that Batman, though, was being compassionate, you know, he's like, let me help you. And then he's like, no, we die together.
Right.
Idiot, I'm trying to save you. And then, you know, then he sees that it's going to blow. But this is the kind of Batman we want. That's like actually trying to help people, you know. It's like even some giant monstrosity that probably, I don't know if they'd ever return this guy back to regular form. It's comics, so maybe, yeah. But yeah, it's a nice touch that, that Batman does care enough that he's trying to help the poor guy.
I love like the panel where he's running and we can see his back, and like it's the light, the heat from the explosion and the fire is so bright. You don't even have like finished lined, like inked lines on his silhouette. It's just like rough pencils, as it's kind of so vague and so smoky that you don't really even see him that well.
Oh yeah, I love that too. I'm glad you pointed that out, because that is just obviously, you know, Samney's a fantastic artist, but just the fact that, and he's a master of economy of line, like we said, like an Alex Toth or a Dave Mazzucchelli, like we said. But the fact that he can barely—he's like you said, you just see like part of Batman's foot that's up while he's running, his leg that's down, and just the barest hint of his cape. But you know that's Batman running away, as like in the coloring, of course, by Lopez, is just like this. It's just a flash as right before everything just totally goes to hell. It's great.
Batman and Robin are both going up. Batman because he's looking for Robin and fighting his way through the goons and the thugs on the stairs, and Robin climbing up the window because he's too high to go down, so he's going to try and get off the roof.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, he's like, well, going up. And yeah, Batman's making, yeah, like you said, he's just low-level goons as he's going up through them. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, he ties the rope that he took to the end of like a sprocket from like a water pump or something like that.
Yeah, it's like a water spigot. Yeah, yeah.
And then he makes that into like a sort of makeshift grappling hook, and he throws it to the next building and misses the first time.
Yeah, I love that bit.
I didn't even think about this now, but like that rope isn't even going straight across. That's quite a down slope. Like there's several floors difference there.
Yeah, I mean, he almost maybe could have ziplined across, you know, took his vest off.
Yeah.
Vest off and ziplined across, yeah.
True, yeah, yeah.
But then he might have, like, slammed into the side of the building if he did that, too, so. Right.
But he's walking across fine, and he sees Batman through the window. He's like, oh, hey, about time, dude. He calls him dude. I love that.
You take a bus or something?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think Batman's got a nice little smirk on his face. That's wonderful.
I like this little moment because, I mean, as this scene will play out, we will see a new bond form between Bruce and Dick by the end of this sequence back in the cave. And they seem tighter and more united. But Bruce's relationship with Alfred is fraying. It's getting a little icy.
Yes, definitely. Alfred is, he has had enough worrying about the kind of danger this kid's getting into and being partially responsible for it. He is, you know, he just can't hardly take it anymore.
Bruce kind of gives him a lecture of like what he discovered about the lab, but they missed their information. They don't know enough because Robin went on his own half-cocked and got himself captured, and they're losing time and intelligence. And while he's doing this, Robin is just kind of, you know, doing his acrobatic stuff, you know, handstands and things like that. And Bruce is like, are you even listening to me? You're so reckless. You're so undisciplined. And Dick takes offense to that.
Yeah.
Because Dick, he's like, undisciplined? How dare you? And you just see Bruce going, careful. Like, where are you going with this?
Yeah. I just imagine going, careful. You know, Yeah, this is like comparing, like his teacher comparing the class to a circus. It's offended Dick that you, like, you're saying I'm undisciplined, you know?
And this builds off of the thing that I was talking about, like, when we covered issue one with, like, how do you realistically justify, I mean, you can't realistically, these characters dressed as bats and robins in costumes, so forget about realism, but how do you justify or suspend your disbelief to say that a child could do this with Batman? And from the very beginning, Mark Waid is like, this is an extraordinary child. He was doing death-defying flips from as soon as he could walk. And that's where he kind of goes on here. He's like, you're not the only one here who's trained his ass off. The Flying Graysons were the greatest aerialists in the world. That took hella work. From the time I was 3, I practiced trapeze 10 hours a day until my hands were covered in blisters. I fell from that tightrope a million times before I learned to gut through the foot and leg cramps. Showmanship is hard. First, like, it's not a show. It's like, you have to take this seriously. And Robin's like, I do. And that's when he kind of goes off on the scene and basically throws it down with Bruce. He's like challenging him. He's like, You can try to ground me. You can take this away from me, but it's too late. I already know how to do this now. You've trained me how to fight crime. And now I've seen what I've seen, that people need us. So you're not going to stop me.
Yeah, this is the scene that cemented this series, how much I loved it. Because, you know, Robin's like, twisted sickos who bring loss and pain to people who don't deserve it. They don't deserve it. And I swear to God, I will keep them from hurting families and kids and anyone. And you can fire me, but you can't stop me. No one can, you know. And then Bruce is like, "Thank you." And he's like, "For what?" You know, for finally saying what I wanted you to say, basically, to get it opening up and saying, "This is why you're doing this." You know, they both want to stop what happened to them from happening to anybody else. And that's the kind of Batman and Robin I want to read about. You know, not crazy You know, Batman might say, I am vengeance, but I don't really want it to be about vengeance. Right. You know, so, you know. Yeah, it's great.
As we leave them, as we go to the final little cliffhanger, a great little moment where we just cut away to the outside shot of the manor. And Bruce, like, now, are you going to teach me how to walk a tightrope or not?
Yeah. One little bit before we get out of this scene, I love at the beginning, he says, Bruce is like, but you cost us. And he says, you mean the bike? We're rich, right? He's like, I'm rich. It's like, there's no we, Kimosabe, right. I'm rich.
Oh, and then we get Grimaldi is setting up his new spot, and we see his father is kind of over there in his wheelchair with his hat kind of tucked away.
Yeah.
And then Two-Face shows up again because we need him back. And he throws down the file. He's like, I bring a gift. And we see all of these pictures of people, you know, Gotham residents. And he's like, this was the file that I took from Gordon's office. It's like, one of these men is Batman.
Yep.
And I was trying to identify if the other names besides Bruce Wayne here are, if they're people we should know, or like if they...
One of them's Brad Pitt, I think. I don't know if it's Pitt. He's got a lot of neck tattoos and stuff, so I think it's supposed to be Brad Pitt.
James Cloud, Nate Spaulding, Kevin Solari, Devin Rigby, Lloyd Copland.
Mark Pattinson, Pattison, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Those names don't ring a bell with me.
People that Mark Waid.
People Mark Waid knows. Yeah, maybe.
Or that, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they were like the first people who followed him, like when he was the editor in chief of Boom Studios. These are like, you know, patrons of that or something like that. And he's like, I'll get you in a comic book someday.
Yeah, might be. Yeah, yeah. And this goes back to Batman Year One. You know, this is like when Gordon came to Bruce's house and he had the model acting like, you know, that didn't, you know, sorry, she doesn't speak English and all that. And he was drinking supposedly champagne, but it was just, you know, sparkling water or whatever, you know, all that. And he brought his wife with him that day, you know, and all that. Remember that scene? So, yeah, it all goes back to that. So it's back to Batman Year One. I think it's interesting that in this series, Two-Face is almost like Grimaldi's annoying neighbor that keeps showing up. Hey, General, what's going on? It's like, oh, Harvey, I don't have time for this right now. You know, it's like, you want to hang out? You know?
It's a great little effect because the first time the door opens, we only see half of his face, the clean side, the unmarked side. And Grimaldi's just like, send him away. But then the door opens the rest of the way and we see that it's Two-Face. That's a very cool little effect that Sammy does.
Yeah, and I like he says, try it and I'll split your skull in two. You know, so it's like, just like yours, you know? Yeah, yeah. And he mentions Batman's dual identity because he's Two-Face. It's not his secret identity. It's his dual identity.
Oh, yeah, you know? So, yeah, good.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, there's one little thing in this comic that Batman does mention again when he's thinking about Dick's origin. I forgot to mention we were talking about that. He does say it was just weeks ago. And I'm still not crazy about that accelerated timeline. I don't understand why Wade, that's my one little minor niggle in this series. I understand why Wade was in such a hurry for him to go from circus acrobat to Robin on the street. You know, I think that's probably quicker than even Bill Finger intended, you know, in the 40s. I just kind of feel like it, but I could be wrong, but I don't know. That's the one little thing that's like, you know, you're trying to establish that, you know, why Batman, like you said, you know, why is Batman endangering this kid? Well, like you said, he's an exceptional kid. And I do think that even back in the 40s, I think that's one reason why they made Dick Grayson a circus acrobat and aerialist, because they did realize, okay, these kids that do this literally defy death every day. It's not like some of these other kids' sidekicks, you know, like, oh, well, you're my pal, so here's a costume, you know, let's go fight crime. You know, it's like, it made absolutely no sense. Like, what the hell, what kind of background did Sandy have to be Sandman's sidekick, you know? he was Diane's nephew in, like, some versions, but it's like, how the hell does that make sense, you know? I mean, you know, but Bucky was the mascot. I know later they made Bucky, like, this crazy marksman, right? But he was, like, the company mascot because his dad died in the troop or whatever, right? So it's like, what the hell is Bucky, you know, Captain America's sidekick? But Robin, made sense. But I, you know, he's building this case for why it makes more sense. But then the accelerated timeline seems to kind of go against it for me. But I need to just let that part go. But I just think it's odd. So
yeah, I kind of agree. No Clayface this issue, but we get the Monster Men, and again, same thing that we saw that you saw in the book, Batman Resurrection. We're getting more of these early, like, Golden Age villains repurposed for this story.
I'm waiting for the Dirigible of Doom, like I mentioned earlier, to show up. Yeah,
I just want to see Batman fight the vampire.
Oh, I do want to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. This was another fun one. Anything else before we head out?
No, I think this, like I said, I think this is the issue that really just that conversation, or, you know, confrontation between Bruce and Dick is kind of an all-timer in my head. If you want to explain Batman and Robin and why they do what they do and the kind of dynamic and the kind of, like you said, the moment that they're bond like Titans, that's and not a Teen Titan, but Titan the other way. That's a fantastic scene. It's beautifully written and beautifully drawn.
And perfectly, like, set up by the fact that we get the revisitation of Dick's origin story and how he became Robin at the beginning of this issue. And by the end of this issue, they have that. They've gelled in that way. We kind of see, like, where this is where the team is kind of solidified, we think.
Yeah.
Yeah, gosh, listeners, I hope you had a fun time listening to our 50th episode of Nightcast with a really great issue of Batman and Robin and an all-time great issue of Detective Comics. Next time, we're going to take a short little break because it's going to be one of our listener feedback episodes. So we're just going to cover one story. It's not going to be one of these stories, and it will have a brand new guest on the show. But you'll have to tune in to find out who that is and what we're talking about. It's going to be a fun story. It's going to be a very unusual story, perhaps even a prose story.
You're going to make me read another story without pictures?
There are a couple.
What are you trying to do to me, Daly? Damn it.
There are like five pictures, and they're by Bill Sienkiewicz, so you can handle it.
Okay.
Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening.